You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Today is the 14th of April, 2021. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, of course, and we are roughly in the middle of Lent. As always, I thank my donors and supporters. Without you guys, this would simply be impossible. And I wouldn't have the freedom to pursue this research and to publish as regularly as I do. The other thing, of course, as I've said before, to apologize for everyone who I haven't been able to get back to. That's something I often can't avoid. My email box is always a mess. You know, there's so many messages, and if I miss anyone, it is not done on purpose. In addition to that, I want to note that the conference that I mentioned in Michigan, which actually would have been this weekend, has been canceled. I don't, fully understand what's going on. Apparently there's some sort of illness. But if anyone was thinking of attending, that's not going to happen. That being said, I mentioned that we are in the middle of Lent. This lecture series deals with the political and ethical elements of the Russian Orthodox Church. And one of the things I've been doing for so many years is covering these topics in all of our shared fields that not a whole lot of people cover or even think are topics. So many issues, personalities, ideas, ideologies that don't get airplay, traction, even amongst our own people. And I want to do that again today. I want to talk about the Orthodox concept of envy and jealousy. I have a paper simply called Envy, The Curse of a World Without God. Most of us at one time or another suffered from this. It is the deadliest of the passions, in my opinion. And for one reason, at least, that it's not pleasurable to have. All the other passions, at least, are fun to a great extent. Envy and jealousy are miserable from the very beginning. We live in a dying age that's simply beyond any, even our normal terms like corruption. It is a moribund, the dying, decaying world. And today, really especially for men, jealousy centers around two things. It centers around money and women. It's very rare to find another cause, although sometimes professional status is important. But even there, it comes down to money and women, and money and romance. It can be a deadly sin, and it doesn't even bring the temporary pleasure to which suffer that so many of the other passions do. Like depression, and really like all mental illnesses, it's based on delusion. It projects a false world, a make-believe world where everyone's a winner but you. The fact is that envy is based on wounded pride, which itself creates depression. The envy then follows when the depressed mind surveys its surroundings. It finds hidden meaning and hidden information in everything. The imagination, you know, runs rampant. It sees insults everywhere. And these things take on a life of their own. Arthur Schopenhauer says, "Pride's worst foe, I mean its greatest obstacle, is vanity, which courts the applause of the world in order to gain the necessary foundation for a high opinion of one's own worth, while pride is based on a pre-existing conception of it." Envy and vanity are closely related. Now again, context is everything here. We are living in a postmodern world, which almost by its very definition is dying. The ancient or medieval ideas on this subject refers to a society that doesn't exist, unfortunately. The problem with the patristic understandings here is that it's referring to a society and a value system that most Westerners, most Americans couldn't comprehend. So you compare medieval, modern, postmodern understandings of this, and you take all this together, coming to a rational and usable definition is a struggle. But locating the sinful aspects of this passion and several others are very complex, but this is a deadly, corrosive idea, and I'm seeing it everywhere. Now, the 10th commandment says, "Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house, neighbor's wife, maidservant, ox, or anything that is his." The concept of this is that God has granted to each man what is required. To reject this is a form of bad faith, but covetousness is the issue here, not envy. There's one thing that I always found entertaining. The self-help parts of the web. I think I've mentioned this before. You want to go, you know, you go to something, you type in getting over envy or getting over depression or something like that. And they're the most idiotic things, including, you know, the more substantial papers from academics. They're all tautologies. So jealousy comes from comparing yourself to a rival. Therefore, by definition, jealousy would be overcome the moment you don't need to compare. And yet, that's the instruction here. There's one online, I saw this some time ago, this sage piece of online advice. It says, "A more useful way to compare is just to compare yourself to yourself. Look at how you've grown and what you have achieved. Appreciate what you've done and what you have. See how far you've come and what you are planning to do." That's not advice, of course. That's the result of what you want to achieve. What he says here, this master of psychology says, in order to stop comparing yourself to others, we have to stop comparing ourselves to others. That's the tautology, this kind of nonsense. This is typical, the online self-help material. There's so many clickbait articles with this kind of thing. Every possible problem, showing the superficiality of the age. I've seen another one. There's a guy, it's the man whose wife is a breadwinner of the family while he stays at home. And the man is very jealous over this. Now, and probably resentful. Here's what this genius says to him. "Regardless if you two are married or have joint finances, a couple is a team. One of your successes should be a win for you both. If one of you achieves a career milestone, celebrate." This is considered advice. See, if you could do any of that stuff, you weren't jealous in the first place. It's the results you want, not advice on how to get there. This is like telling someone with depression to stop feeling bad. It's the person who says, "Give it over to God," when you explain a problem to them. It's a shallow mass mind that's never thought, it's not capable of thinking deeply about its emotions or mental states. Passions, especially today, are too well developed and too well entrenched to be destroyed with a little willpower. The problem is, of course, with all of these stupid self-help things, is that the will and the mind have already been hijacked. Here's another one. It says, what's the key to getting over your envy of other people's beauty? It's all about embracing the natural beauty that God gave you. Stop obsessing over what others have that you don't, and start focusing on your most beautiful and unique traits. This is the mass mind. This is a tautology. It doesn't help anybody. It essentially says, to get over being jealous of someone's beauty, don't worry about their beauty. And you see this everywhere. But it shows the nonsense of the postmodern self-help industry. This is what's replaced the orthodox understanding of the passions. And this goes for any problem people have. If you're clear-headed enough to read and understand that kind of thing, then you never had a problem in the first place. The problem with the passions is that it has hijacked cognition itself. Rational thinking doesn't have an impact. So even appealing to reality doesn't have any benefit. That's the problem with the passions. When you have a postmodern world that is so exhausted, that's so bereft of ideas, that has no insight into itself, this is the most you're going to get. As this regime goes deeper and deeper into decay, you're going to start seeing increasing levels of irrationality. Whole industries based on quick fixes, cults, all kinds of weird religions, all kinds of communes, all kinds of Eastern meditation, and this kind of thing is going to be exploding because there is no insight into the passions. There is no understanding for all the billions that go into psychology departments. There is no insight, especially in the mass mind, because they don't know how to think deeply about it. This is the postmodern self-help industry. Because of the nature of the passions, it makes, they're difficult to uproot because they've already captured the mind that you have to use to uproot it. It is, to be kind, it's a bit simplistic. Passions aren't just bad habits. They're distortions. Like all mental illness, they distort both thought and reality. See, if truth had an impact, there wouldn't be a problem. Truth doesn't have an impact because the mechanism by which we perceive truth has been damaged, as has a connection between thought and will. In other words, you could know the truth and still not feel it or be able to act on it. You may know something is true. You don't want to admit that something is true. The dying postmodern world has no idea how to deal with the problems that it creates. And it's based on its very own ideology. If self-interest is what we all act on, and self-interest is what we're supposed to pursue, then envy doesn't make any sense. The existence of mass envy is evidence that the regime promotes an unnatural ideology, at least for certain groups. They've not dealt with the fact that envy is deliberately inculcated as a weapon, especially against men in particular. But this kind of self-help nonsense is just emotional hand-wringing. Metropolitan Horophius of Lakos, in his The Science of Spiritual Medicine in 2010, he says, the sickness of envy is one of the soul's worst illnesses. It does great damage to the envious person's soul, as well as causing serious distress to others. Someone in the grip of envy does not consider friends, relatives, or benefactors. Unhappiness is a distinguishing characteristic of the envious person. Usually, the envious man doesn't want to admit his sickness or reveal the wound to his soul, so he is constantly miserable. Now, of course, jealousy and envy are not synonymous. Confusion between the two is very frequent in daily speech. Jealousy tends to be interpersonal and usually almost entirely romantic or financial, but envy is about things. Now, for our purposes, I'm using the two interchangeably. As a passion in terms of moral theology, they're the same. So envy is defined as a lack. It's a lack of what another has that's very intensely desired. It becomes a problem when the person is convinced that another has what he desires due to injustice or unfairness. Jealousy is about fear of loss. So by envy, what I'm talking about here includes both people and things for the sake of this discussion. So both the fear of loss and the wish for gain. Envy is extremely corrosive today. But what is a passion? Orthodox people talk about passions all the time. A passion is an unnatural drive of the soul. Maximus the Confessor puts it like this. It's something like physical disease is unnatural to our body. The concept of a passion, we get the word patient from it. We get the word passive from it. It's something heteronymous. It happens to us rather than our making it happen. St. Clement of Alexandria says, passion is an excessive feeling or appetite going beyond what is reasonable. Passions are a disturbance of our soul contrary to our nature. In disobedience to reason, passion is not natural and it ruins our nature instead of fulfilling it. It is, to use Platonic terms, it's when the appetitive part of the soul overwhelms the rational part. And often we know there's something wrong, but we just can't help it. And we can't do anything about it. As I've said, the biggest problem with the passions is that it hijacks the very faculties that you need to fight it. Envy and jealousy, again, I'm trying to use these synonymously. But one definition from Metropolitan Herotheus says, envy is mainly sadness at our neighbor's happiness and joy at his misfortune. Usually the envious person is anxious and overcome by unbearable sorrow, not because something bad has happened to him, but because something good has happened to another. He takes no account of his own blessings and does not praise God for the benefits bestowed on him every day. Instead, he is tormented by his brother's happiness. He is distressed because his brother is glad and possesses more than he does. But that's not how envy presents itself today. It's not never merely the fact that someone has a good fortune. For jealousy to be present, you have to have two things, at least two things. The first, that there has to be a rival or even an enemy. And the second is that good fortune of the other person has to be unearned or received unfairly. So, of course, now you see why this is such a crucial topic. Now, it doesn't excuse it, of course, but it makes it more understandable. It is, by definition, irrational. It is at war with reason. Very few in the history of humanity have ever been angry at a random object that someone else has. There's always a great degree of complexity behind it. Metropolitan Herotheus, he had some more detail, though. He says, the envious man examines other people's lives and tries to compare his life with theirs. When he realizes that his brother surpasses him, he lets the terrible passion of envy show itself. The first sign is distress and misery. Sorrow and despondency never leave the envious man. The physical and spiritual merits of others become a source of sorrow and gloom. Even their material possessions upset him. He has eyes everywhere. He's always carefully watching for grounds to make an accusation. When the victim of envy is praised, the envious man is ready to contradict. The passion of envy may be carefully hidden by sorrow and a tendency to criticize. Envy has terrible consequences. It distorts a person's soul. Clearly, my listeners know why I'm bringing this up. We live in an age of oligarchy. They rule it over us without mercy. The Great Reset is about eliminating possessions in exchange for debt relief for all but a few. But Metropolitan Herotheus, the problem of what he's saying here is that there's no context here. Again, it's not just any random brother out there. At its very best, it's a sullen recognition of an injustice that has the sanction of law. In other words, we just can't take the desired object from him. He's right about the intense unhappiness of the jealous man. His perception is distorted. He does find meaning in things that don't exist because he's striving to justify his envy by seeing examples of injustice against him everywhere. Like all of these forms of projection, the man under this passion isn't really perceiving anything. He's imposing and projecting his distorted state onto the external world. This is a hijacking of our faculties in general. problem with these definitions is that the anger is at someone who possesses a valued object. That's not the concern. Why it angers him is. So consider, you know, one of, if not the most common element of jealousy, which is women, or a romantic relationship. A man sees his neighbor with a wife a lot hotter than his own. Now, it bothers him because he's hardwired by postmodernity to believe that the purpose of a man's life is to please women. If he doesn't get the hottest girl, he's a failure. If the man's wife is getting fat and his neighbor's is in excellent shape, this must mean, in his mind, that her incentive to look good comes from something that the first man can't provide. If the neighbor's wife takes good care of herself and his does not, then the reason might be that she doesn't have to earn his affection. She doesn't care. She sees him as a weak male that's not going anywhere. A man that won't cheat because he has too few options. She can afford to take him for granted. The other man's wife, on the other hand, sees that her husband has lots of other options. She has to stay hot for him. Now, that might not be the case at all, but this is a trap of envy's perception. And this is often the context for modern envy, and it's rare that reality has anything to do with it. Now, in the medieval world, Gregory of Sinai stresses a different aspect of this. He says, those who are completely given over to pursuits of the flesh and full of self-love are always slaves to sensual pleasure and to vanity. Envy, too, is rooted in them. Now, this makes a lot more sense than the Metropolitan. This is always, almost always about money and women. When a man makes his life about those things, jealousy is almost guaranteed. So it has to revolve around whatever the society holds most valuable. The value system of the envious man is disordered. The envy is, as we said before, the two related things of sex and material things. But of course, for the Christian, such possessions are secondary. But this is 2021. We are born and raised in a society that from birth stresses that those goods are the ultimate goods. So any kind of critique of them, as true as it might be, is still just words on paper. It's not just an irrational belief, but it's in our brain's very hard wiring. It's the brain's precognitive immediate state. Therefore, you know, willpower and reason and thought can't fight it because it's seeped into the very structure of thought to begin with. So St. Gregory says, envious people, by the very fact that they're envious, so they don't have love. The envious man cannot and does not want to love. The envious man also destroys what he has. Envy consumes the soul that bears it. Now, the problem with the patristic comments is that the competitive individualism that rules the West today was simply unknown at the time. To have more than someone else in the ancient world was not a cause for jealousy. And certainly not the same objects as today it would be. Competitive individualism is one of the driving forces here. That was not enshrined as ideology at the time, but it is now. But the other comment that St. Gregory says is that envy destroys the envier, even what he has, because you start seeing what he does have is worthless, because he doesn't have a socially valued object or not enough of it. So using the two wives example, for example, at some point the wounded husband is going to confront her. Being told that she's inferior to the other might destroy the marriage and lose whatever he does have. But the envious man is aware that this is a possibility, but he is overcome with this passion. This is the nature of the passions in general. St. Nikitas says, lack of faith is evil, the worst offspring of wicked avarice and envy. See, the envious, we're saying, torture themselves with this obsession. He says, such people state slanderously that good is bad, calling it the fruit of deceit, even if it is not. These do not accept things of the Spirit or believe in them. Because of their lack of faith, they can't see or know God. So here, at least, he recognizes that the envious man thinks that the blessings on his rival are fruits of deceit, unearned benefits. But the passion of envy also injures those against whom it's directed. Nicodemus the Hagarite says, the offsprings of envy are conspiracy, malice, spite, argumentation, slander, fraud, betrayal, and murder. The point is that either the sin eats away at the envy of your soul, becoming an obsession, or he attempts to steal the object away from the other, causing conflict. So Maximus the Confessor analyzes the case of Saul persecuting David in spite of being treated kindly by him. He says that anyone who, out of envy, hates and vilifies the man because he outshines him in the struggle for virtue is choked by an evil spirit. But the problem with this kind of talk is that we live in 2021. That kind of envy doesn't exist. It's over a very different set of objects. And we have very little control over those. I have never met a human being that's ever been consumed by envy because someone outshines him in virtue. Our age is too decadent for those concerned. Envy is exclusively material since it's about the verification of one's social standing and therefore one's significance. George Aquaro says, as a priest, an excellent book on the topic, "The careful reader will see that everything belongs to the Creator, then to believe that one deserves something is in fact self-idolatry. The Decalogue shows the dynamic that idolatry leads to envy, which leads to murder. Only in a slight preference aside from God is one idolatrous and capable of sin. This slight preference for oneself instead of God reveals that one deserves something more than God. It's the seed of envy. The deceit of Adam and Eve was their own belief that they deserved to eat of the tree. So our acknowledgement of God's sovereignty and unlimited riches by the pursuit of humility, expressed by St. Paul in his letter to Timothy, can help us in our healing from envy. And having food and clothing, with these we shall be content." But it begs the question. You see this in all of the Christian and Orthodox writings on this topic. It begs the question. It seems to imply that the gain of one over another is just and according to merit. But envy doesn't come from this. A man who has taken what doesn't belong to him contravenes God's will. He lives for himself. So God's not the only actor in this particular case. There is free will involved. Jealousy is a recognition of injustice rather than inexplicable concern that someone is more just than another. William Hazlitt, 1923, he says, "Envy, among other ingredients, has a mixture of the love of justice in it. We are more angry at undeserved than deserved good fortune." Now that's what the other definitions seem to exist. What Father George is saying is that God has arranged all things for the remnant. Hence, everything that exists is due to a large overarching plan. So again, Metropolitan Herodotus says, "We need to show particular love towards those people whom we feel inwardly inclined to envy. In particular, we ought to pray about the passion. Also pray for those whom we feel tempted to envy. We should regard everything that our brother has as gifts of God's grace. He is a giver of all gifts. Spiritual guidance is needed from a priest skilled in the Orthodox way of healing." No disrespect to the Metropolitan, but so far he has just listed a series of platitudes. The problem is simply spoken in the abstract. That's not how envy works. So, for example, if we come home from work and our wife is gone, having left us for somebody, someone wealthier and better looking, for example, any concept of love seems strangely out of place. In that case, the anger is righteous. Now, in the ancient world in general, an example like that would simply be impossible. The insulted man would have many weapons at his disposal. Today, the victim, especially if he's male, is told to just man up and take it, and we've seen this many times. So consider two men working in a factory, for example. One lies about the other in order to gain a better position. Maybe the second man might even have lost his job over the slander. Then he sees the liar enjoying his new position with all the prestige and money that goes along with it. Now, is his, quote, success a matter for envy? Is it sinful to hold him in contempt? Is it a sin to be intensely jealous of such a man? Is resentment felt towards such a rank injustice a sin? This is the problem. And the much older, the patristic understandings of envy don't fit this dying age. They lived in a much more healthy age. The church fathers didn't live in an age of possessive individualism. So much of they saw as envy doesn't have much resemblance to our twisted world. I mean, the worst of the Roman Empire was a moral utopia compared to the best of today. So when new readers come across church fathers for the first time, they seem foreign. You have to put yourself in a place from which they're writing and then extrapolate their meanings to our own, which is no easy task. The key concept is possessive individualism, a very famous 1962 work by C.B. McPherson. It's a book that those who go into grad school for political theory read about 10 million times. It's absolutely essential because he's talking about the break in consciousness between the classical and the modern era, or the medieval and the modern era, that leads to these passions taking on different forms. He says, the present study, and he's talking about the book, suggests that the difficulties of modern liberal democratic theory lie deeper than had been thought, that the original 17th century individualism contained the central difficulty, which lay in its possessive quality. Its possessive quality is found in its conception of the individual essentially the proprietor of his own person and capacities, owing society nothing. The individual was seen neither as a moral whole nor part of a larger social whole, but an owner of himself. The relations of ownership having become more and more men critically important relation determining their actual freedom and actual prospect of realizing their potentiality, was read back into the nature of the individual. The individual, it was thought, is free inasmuch as he is proprietor of his person and capacities. Human essence is freedom from dependence on the wills of others, and freedom is a function of possession. Society becomes a lot of free, equal individuals related to each other as proprietors of their own capacities and of what they have acquired by their exercise. Society, therefore, consists of an exchange between proprietors. That mentality is a revolutionary break you see in Thomas Hobbes. I've always identified Thomas Hobbes like Leo Strauss identified Machiavelli. This is the breaking philosopher. Everything changed after him. The notion of possessive individualism is the core of modernity. And as McPherson says, it's found in its conception of the individual as essentially the proprietor of his own person or capacities, owing society nothing for them. The problem is, the fathers had no conception of this perversion. So, the family, for example, can't exist in a world of possessive individualism. Envy dominates our world. It's one of the most vicious passions because the goods pursued are material. McPherson, coming from Hobbes, is an accurate definition of modern life, and therefore the envy is intrinsic to it. Motivations are artificially conjured. Modern society, as he says, is little more than just exchange among proprietors, which means that the most manipulative will do the best. Adam Smith's naivete notwithstanding, envy is built into the modern system because deviousness, not virtue, is rewarded, which of course was Machiavelli's revolutionary schism. Thus, envy at the success, quote-unquote, of another is based on the contempt for the present system, the system of incentives, not the man in question. I mean, after all, the person who's being envied is just following what he's been taught. It is martyrdom. It's torture for anyone in this position. But the individualistic nature of the modern West has this already built into its structure. So whether it's one's livelihood destroyed through slander, or a spouse abandoning her husband for another, the suffering is both intense and highly unnatural. The individualism this all implies was far into the patristic age, and of course does nothing but show the evil of our modern world. The modern man, the modern mass man, knows only money and sex. He knows only irrational drives. Therefore, the passions that the church fathers systematized and showed condemned and showed their destructiveness, they're not aberrations from our world. They are our world. So the problem is, because of that, the concept of envy and jealousy offered by the church fathers don't seem to match our experience. Because envy today comes from the losing the war of possessions, including lives and families. Not some abstract realization that somewhere some man is doing better than we are in some nameless way. It's a matter of socialization. It's very hard to uproot. Envy derives today in our own lives from something of ours being stolen by fraud, something of great personal significance. And because the system benefits those people, we remain helpless and forgotten as a result. This is jealousy, not the irrational feelings of which the fathers are talking about. The questions I asked before, are feelings of envy and anger irrational within a system that's designed to provoke them? The economic system today, which does center around sexual matters, was totally foreign to the fathers. I think the perversion of modernity and postmodernity would be beyond their capacity to describe. They don't have the vocabulary. So St. Basil the Great says, "Brothers, let us escape this illness," he's referring to envy, "that teaches hostility to God, the mother of murder, which confounds nature, ignores friendship, and is the most irrational misfortune. Let us escape this unbearable vice. It is a lesson learned from the serpent, an invention of the demons, the seed sown by the enemy, a foretaste of damnation, an obstacle to devotion, the road to hell and the loss of the kingdom." And all of that is very true. It is the result. Ultimately, comes it's you know, if pride is the root, this is a corrosive element of pride that's activated by individualism. So, what you know, to translate that into our language. A man is granted a promotion that gets us angry since we think we're the ones who deserve it. As a result, we begin inventing reasons to believe that it was done through fraud. We're normally talking about arbitrary events or acts of fraud that destroy our situation in a very real way. That's not a pathological drive, but it could be. Pathology is never in accordance with facts, since all mental illnesses are based on some form of delusion. In the modern era, things change very little. The evil is acting to the thing that gets us jealous, not the jealousy itself. But in modernity, it's institutionalized, it's rubbed in our faces. The result, of course, is, as Hobbes explained, the never-ending drive for dominance. The Psalms, in the Book of Psalms, it says, "I was envious of the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. For they have no pangs until death. Their bodies are fat and sleek. They are not in trouble as others are, not stricken like the rest of mankind. Therefore pride is their necklace. Violence covers them as a garment. They scoff and speak with malice. Loftily they threaten oppression. They set their mouths against the heavens, and their tongue struts through the earth. Therefore his people turn back to them and find no fault in them. And they say, how can God know? Is there knowledge in the Most High? Behold, these are the wicked, always at ease. They increase in riches. All in vain have I kept my heart clean and washed my hands in innocence, for all the day long I have been stricken and rebuked every morning. If I had said I would speak thus, I would have been betrayed, the generation of your children. But when I thought how to understand this, it seemed to me a wearisome task until I went into the sanctuary of God, and there I discovered their final end." This is one of the reasons that the Old Testament is so critical. King David here is certain that the elites which he's talking about are illegitimate. They haven't earned their positions. These people seem to have no problems, or at least not the problems that torture him. Those who are privileged have fewer problems. And that sort of person creates a very different, it sort of creates a different personality. It's arrogant but still brittle. Since a lot of these people have never felt suffering, even the slight inconvenience is seen as intolerable. Why would they need God? It's like asking why hot women need feminism. It's absurd for them. They get anything they want based on sexual attraction. Everything else is superfluous. In other words, without pain, one doesn't know how to call on God. But using words like riches, that's certainly more than just cash. It implies reputation, physical beauty, prestigious position, and all the rest. What the psalmist is saying here is that he realizes he's done the right thing only to be punished. Those others have done evil, and they are rewarded. This is because the world is the domain of evil. Even then, as Israel began to decay and oligarchy developed, to be successful requires vices and a lack of conscience, not the virtues. And this realization causes great suffering. Again, the difference between then and now is that today it is institutionalized and considered virtuous. But when the psalmist talks about their end, their final end, what is it? Well, even the most privileged of women will soon grow old. She's racked by insecurities. Men start running for younger, stupider girls. She might soon think that this is the time to finally turn to God, but there's no guarantee God will respond, because it's based on bad faith. It's a transactional conversion. God is not a machine. He is a respecter of persons in that sense. He knows our motives far better than we do. Remember, hell is where we send ourselves. It's our conscience. The judgment is when the man, after death, encased in grace, in light, such that no bad faith rationalizations could ever work. It's the exposure of the motives for our actions. The bad conscience is hell, and he will condemn himself, since no dishonesty is possible in front of God. Even more, it's clear that even the most problem-free elite is worried. It doesn't take much to lose everything. Their placid demeanor is largely an act. Even before that, Aristotle says, envy is pain at the good fortune of others, from the Rhetoric. But it's never an abstract other, but it's always a rival. It always comes at our expense, and it always deals with an issue of great personal significance. That's the concern. It exists at our weakest point, and our worst moments. Right? No one has ever flown into a rage because their neighbor's Mercedes is slightly more attractive than their own, unless there's some delusion involved. Aristotle says, jealousy is both reasonable and belongs to reasonable men, while envy is base and belongs to the base. For the one makes himself get good things by jealousy, while the other does not allow his neighbor to have them through envy. In this case, envy is where you destroy something so another can't have it. Jealousy, in this conception, drives you forward to self-improvement. In the second part of the Rhetoric, Aristotle argues essentially that envy comes after indignation. And these two are often confused. It's not envy when someone is truly cheated. Envy, on the other hand, has more to do with the things that we failed to gain, but that a rival has, all other things being equal. Envy can only exist among equals. In a society based on hierarchy, those superior to us rightfully own what they do. Those inferior to us have such meager taste that we can only look condescendingly in what they think is good, what they think is valuable. But among equals, that's another matter. So it comes down to two men having equal chances in life, with one successful and the other not. This, in Aristotle's mind, is where envy arises. In the West, in the High Middle Ages, Thomas Aquinas says, in one way, when someone is saddened by another's good, insofar as the danger of some harm threatens it because of that good, when a man is saddened by the elevation of his enemy, fearing that his enemy will then do him harm, as Aristotle points out in the second part of the Rhetoric, this sort of sadness is not envy, but is instead the effect of fear. In other words, as I've been saying, it's not the good fortune of a rival, but it can be traced to something else. If that's the case, then it's not envy. In Aristotle's point of view, if the unworthy man has been fraudulently granted something of value, it's not envy. It's a legitimate resentment stemming from true injustice. So the alternative, Aquinas says, quote, the other's good is thought of as bad for oneself, insofar as it diminishes one's own glory or excellence. That's truly sinful and irrational in Aquinas' point of view. Aquinas says, in a third way, one is saddened by another's good insofar as the one to whom the good accrues is undeserving of it. This sort of sadness cannot arise from the upright good by which one becomes just. And what he means by this is that not all goods are equal. The question is the internal order of the soul. The indignation has more to do with the values a man places on external things. So to be envious of wealth or sexual conquest is really about one making these things as goods, when in fact the desire itself is sinful. Aquinas makes it clear elsewhere that it is the object, not the person, that incites anger, the indignation, the envy. If one believes that they deserve riches and don't get it for some reason, this has to do with a disordered soul, since riches are hardly an unmixed blessing. Often, women come with far more grief than pleasure. For one to be jealous because our neighbor's wife is prettier than our own comes down to saying that our narcissistic self-image is more important than the institution of marriage, all the things being equal. One is jealous over riches when they're considered the highest calling of man. It's riches themselves, not the cause of gain, that's the problem here. A system that stresses other goods would not have sharp jealous rages over money or women, which is what makes our era so unique. The Christian sees more temptation than pleasure coming from these things, and should never be envious, though that's a tall order, of course. It's a tall order because of the values with both of us were raised. The Christian improvement over Aristotle's view is about the relationship of external goods to the soul. If anything, the Christian pities the man and mocks the man who thinks he's successful because he can afford a slightly newer SUV than his neighbor. In other words, it's sinful to envy the man who has a better car or a nicer house if he has not harmed you in getting it and has gotten it legitimately, received it legitimately. Now, on the other hand, if those things lead to your wife leaving you for him, we've now left the realm of envy and entered the realm of righteous indignation. The Israelites would have stoned both of them. Today, of course, she's just improving her situation. Immanuel Kant says centuries later, envy is a propensity to view the well-being of others with distress, even though it doesn't distract from your own. It's a reluctance to see our own well-being overshadowed by another's because the standard we use to see how well off we are is not the intrinsic worth of our own well-being, but how it compares with that of others. Envy aims, at least in terms of one's wishes, at destroying others' good fortune. But again, like all the others, it seems, this is rarely the case. When a situation does not take from us directly, envy may be considered irrational. But the modern world gives us plenty of exceptions. The anger that's felt by the envier is precisely because of the harm done to him. Sexual envy. It does detract from ourselves, since when a woman chooses another one, not a man's rival, it's a massive assault on her self-esteem. He simply isn't good enough, no matter how well he may have treated her. It's a common refrain. In this case, how do you avoid comparison? How is anger irrational? Is the pain of being sinned against itself a sin? Should the sufferings of this man be compared or compounded by the fact that he's now in sin? It's bad enough that he's suffering this way, but now to tell him that he's in deadly sin because of it? Adam Smith, wildly misinterpreted, talks about this in his Theory of Moral Sentiments. He says, envy is that passion which views with malignant dislike the superiority of those who are really entitled to all the superiority they possess. Now that's the key distinction. Resentment is probably the better term. That's for someone who does well due to fraud or deceit. Envy is when the person, frankly, is actually better than you in some important way. Jealousy is the anger resulting from the realization that we're actually not good enough when compared with another. But Adam Smith, being a utilitarian, realizes the problem. Neil Burton, and he comes as close to the criticism that I've been given to these arguments. He comes closest. He says, for envy to take root, three conditions have to be met. First, we must be confronted with a person or persons of superior quality, achievement, or possession. Second, we must desire that quality for ourselves or wish that the other person lacked it. And third, we must be pained by the associated emotion. In sum, envy is the pain caused by the desire for the advantages of others. In Old Money, Nelson Aldrich Jr. describes the beginning of the pain of envy as the almost frantic sense of emptiness inside oneself, as if the pump of one's heart were sucking on air. Now, the only problem with Burton's definition is that the person with superior achievement must also be a rival. Again, the person causing the envy is never an abstraction, so his conditions fail to some extent. So consider the two wives again mentioned above. Now I use this because it's a very common area for violent jealousy. It seems to apply to men and women, with women having a slightly higher propensity to the emotion. Now, most of us are aware of the red pill, where a man's worst nightmare is cuckoldry, or living with a cheating wife either in ignorance or impotence. Men have killed to prevent this from happening. Now, for envy to develop in this case, there's a few things that have to develop in the mind of the jealous partner. Number one, there must be a rival, real or perceived, a personal, incredible threat. Number two, the marriage has to be seen as very valuable in itself. Number three, his self-esteem should be pretty low to begin with. Four, there has to be a trust issue at some level. Five, the marriage must be a generally happy one otherwise. Number six, his spouse is believed to be morally capable of infidelity. And finally, number seven, he has to possess what we call a scarcity mentality. That is, replacing the current partner would be difficult and costly, if not impossible. Now, only when those conditions exist do marital or romantic jealousy begin to make sense. Again, using red pill terminology, the first thing to notice is that only in the unregulated dating market, as we call it, is such a set of things even conceivable. So therefore, this is a postmodern problem. Now, in the mainline psychological literature, which is never good, I don't care what topic it is, a guy named Gary Hansen, I could just picture him, 1985, does virtue signaling even back then. He says, this conception of jealousy implies that two factors are necessary before an individual will be jealous. The first factor is the individual defining his partner's actual or imagined behavior as conflicting with his definition of marriage. The second entails the individual viewing the relationship as valuable. The behavior of the partner need not be sexual. Jealousy can arise from one's partner being involved with children, professional colleagues, or even solitary activities, if such behavior is contrary to the person's definition of marriage and the relationship is valued. It was published in Social Psychology Quarterly. And it's very typical of the disaster of academic psychology. Now, it's a whole new list of errors here. Now, we're talking about adultery in marriage, often leading to violence. Now, he needs to be told that there is no marital jealousy that is not sexual. Hansen knows this. The dishonesty here is when he uses the phrase conflicting with one's definition of marriage. That's a stupid virtue signal, since Hansen is trying to throw the blame back onto the victim. It's never the issue, and it's never a subjective matter. It was both of their conceptions at one point, since they dedicated themselves to each other exclusively when they got married. That's not controversial. Now, the appearance of a rival gave her an excuse to alter the terms of the contract. Suddenly, the appearance of the rival alters the cheater's conception of the marriage fairly rapidly. He knows this too, but because there is a drive to rationalize female adultery, even in the mid-80s. But still, despite that stupidity, he's actually adding to the solution to the problem. Jealousy, especially in the romantic realm, is an aspect of projection. Generally, what you have is one's fantasies of success are projected onto another. There's a new phenomenon that some of you may have come across called retroactive jealousy. Again, this is only possible in the postmodern world. This is where one partner pictures what his current love did with other men in the past. And it's really a fantasy because the men that she was with before, in your imagination, are always porn stars. Well, you know, the poor guy sees himself as Pauly Shore. It's destroying relationships constantly. It strongly suggests that the American mind is leading a completely irrational and unnatural life. But these are usually projections. It's rarely factual. But it's not too far removed from delusion, where one becomes jealous over an entirely invented situation. This dips into serious pathology. The man, in this case, will discover signs and proofs, quote-unquote, of infidelity everywhere he looks. Every gesture has a hidden meaning. And the hidden meaning always is you're a loser and screaming at him. It begins to appear like psychosis. But now we're living in an age where female adultery is justified and promoted. To talk about jealousy, even the retroactive version, that is called shame language. And it blunts the force of the legitimate anger against these type of things. You could be told, you say something and someone says, oh, you're just jealous. Which in and of itself is often an admission of illegitimacy. The concept of retroactive jealousy came into existence in the first place to justify the results of the sexual revolution. It justifies the other partner's promiscuity by blaming the victim. And it is connected with feminism. The feeling isn't sinful in and of itself. It is natural and expected under the circumstances. Envy can never be, that's the whole point, envy can never be connected with justice, only personal arrogance. It's sinful only to the extent that it's not concerned with justice at all. To be jealous over the good that's been legitimately earned is a sin. To be jealous over a good that has been stolen from you is not. But our postmodern concern with envy is curious. Because the system that produces these ideas is the very same system that creates this very institutional foundation. So young women today, they go out of their way to engender envy, and men keep them off balance. That's not hard to do. In fact, men aren't even allowed to feel jealous over their partner's behavior at all. But envy, to be such, has to concern distributive justice. When it leaves that realm, it becomes not only sinful, but pathological. So, when feelings of envy derive from either fantasy or legitimate achievement, that's the problem. It's sinful in both cases. But when it derives from clear injustice, it is not. Envy deriving from adultery or slander, using the examples above, is not sinful, but in fact a normal reaction to the sin of others. The older the patristic ideas on the subject were not able to address these concerns because their society was not nearly as corrupt as ours. It's almost impossible to compare them all, to compare the two societies at all. And it should be kept in mind that envy has to be pathological, hatred for someone that, without harming you or anyone else, has something that you think you desire. It can never be applied to the man who's suffering due to rank injustice. The concept of retroactive jealousy is, there's apparently this gigantic literature on it, and it's fascinating. And it shows how the concept of jealousy has been manipulated. The point is to justify bad female sexual behavior in the past by throwing the concern onto you. You were the problem because you dare worry about this kind of thing. You're a problem because she has more options and can do what she pleases. It's a way to distract attention from the fact that this is a very abnormal situation. I've said before, and even good historians don't make this distinction, that men and women, boys and girls, did not mix at all until the 17th century, the 18th century. They had no social connection whatsoever. If you were single, you didn't see one another. You were not educated together. Recreation was not together. You didn't work together. Even in church, you were separated. If you saw teenagers together somewhere with no adult around, you would be beaten. It is absolutely out of the question. And it's important to note that because the society was not hypersexualized, this sort of thing wasn't the sine qua non of your life. Hypersexuality today, of course, makes everything into a big sexual projection. Therefore, it becomes the goal to be pursued, and this develops into these pathologies. But even there, any of these examples that I've been using, jealousy is not a problem if it comes from legitimate injustice. Someone says, "Oh, you're just jealous." In many cases, you say, "I sure am, and I should be, and so would you be." The older, the classical, patristic, even the early modern conceptions of jealousy are strangely abstract. But the ancients didn't have any conceptions of self-esteem. That hyper-individualistic, media-generated personalities didn't exist. It wasn't even conceivable. They didn't have a language that could describe it, even if it was shown to them. And that's why it's so difficult when you're reading the ancients or understanding any of these passions, because our societies aren't nearly the same. Some of the definitions that I've been reading are, you know, so extremely mundane. No one has ever been angry because some guy up the street has a nicer car than you. That's never how this works. It's very personal and goes straight to the heart of how a person views themselves. If you are, and the point of this, you know, the ultimate point of all of this, is that the way the regime is working now, they torment our people in the worst possible way. They say that money and power are the ultimate goals to pursue, and then create a system where it's impossible to achieve them. Therefore, not only jealousy and envy built into the system, it's encouraged. Now you have an ideology that says the act of being jealous over these things shows that you are weak and shows that you are worthless. This is a very sophisticated attack on especially the male self-esteem in all of these cases. Because now it's rendering their legitimate anger and hatred, that reaction, that natural revulsion from evil, it delegitimizes it and says it's a simple jealousy and you need to get over it. The point of it all is that that concept, that term, you're just jealous, is a way to block, negate, and humiliate those who've actually been sinned against. That's been the thesis here. That's the concept. The idea is that the anger that our people feel over being removed from even the most basic of social rewards, that anger is seen now with some pathological circumstance. And that demoralizes our people further. That's the issue. They know that there's a tremendous amount of anger bubbling under the surface. Not the media-created anger like you have going now. I mean legitimate, long-term, the anger that comes from actually being oppressed and removed from social life. It is under the surface. The point is to take that natural anger and revulsion, claim it's jealousy, and it shows you how weak and stupid you are. And capitalism, to a great extent, while deliberately inculcating jealousy, also then uses it as a way to demoralize people further. Not everyone who has failed in certain things is a loser. And certainly not everyone who's successful in certain things is a winner. The very existence, the very possession of something of social value automatically gives legitimacy to the person, no matter how they may have gotten it. So to try to blunt legitimate anger that comes from our contempt of the oligarchy by simply saying it's jealousy is a way to forestall a counter-revolution. That's the point here. Our conceptions of jealousy are critical. And we make the distinction between the envy that comes from personal arrogance and delusion and that which comes from an objective understanding of oppression. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.